history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell, and you'll be amazed if you just take the time to ask and listen. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to hear from a World War II veteran today who will be 93 at the end of July. And for almost all of those 93 years, he's been in the wonderful city of Clovis, California, a city that really loves its veterans and takes care of them. And I'm just wondering, 93 years, and you came here to Clovis when you were just a little guy. Your father brought you from Oklahoma. What's the biggest difference from Clovis in 2016 compared to the 1920s when you got here?
Well, there was 900 people in Clovis, and gas was 12 cents a gallon, and we could buy an old Model T for $35, and now it's over 100,000.
Yeah, and you guys had a Model T.
Yeah.
Did you have to crank it up?
Yeah, I had to crank it. No starter.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Touring. Didn't have a door on the driver's side. It was a three-door.
Mm-hmm.
Because you crawl over to drive.
Right. Most of the people that are living in Clovis now, it's a lot bigger than 900 people. It's over 100,000 people in 2016. And most of them weren't alive during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those years, and what were the biggest challenges you faced?
Well, me, I had to quit school because my dad just couldn't afford us. There was five of us. So me and my dad and brother went over to Raisin City, and we set grapes out, mm-hmm. planted grapes, and we got 15 cents an hour apiece. The three of us made 45 cents an hour, and we was glad to get it because there wasn't any work. It was the only work there was farm work. I drove a tractor when I was 12 years old, plowing cotton and that kind of stuff.
And when you say you quit school, you quit after the eighth grade. From kindergarten to eighth grade, you went to school right on the same piece of land where you live now in Clovis, but you quit at the eighth grade because the family needed everybody to work.
Yeah, right.
And I imagine for folks who don't know this part of Central California, maybe they don't know how far that is, but Clovis to Raisin City, that was probably quite a haul in an old Model T.
Yeah, well, gas was 9 cents a gallon. an old Model T got good gas mileage.
Uh-huh.
So we could go over there and back on half a gallon or so.
Uh-huh.
There just wasn't any work at all. And just farm labor. We picked up figs at that time of the year. We cut grapes and we picked cotton.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and brother and I were food tramps at one time. We went to Lodi and picked cherries and Patterson and picked apricots.
Uh-huh.
And left my mother and the younger ones here.
So you would go wherever there was a crop to be harvested?
Yeah.
So you could make money?
Yeah. We picked cherries for 7 cents a gallon. So you can imagine how much money we made. But at that time, everybody was poor. My dad finally got a foreman job on a ranch on Shaw between Maple and Cedar. His boss farmed all that land. My dad got to be the foreman. And we had Zola Pendergrass, Betty Pendergrass, all the doctor's kids working out there too.
Uh-huh.
We worked in a cutting shed. One of us kids would get sick, and my doctor would come to the house, and my mother didn't have any money, so she'd give him a chicken.
Uh-huh.
And that was the pay.
Yeah, times were different.
Yeah.
Well, if there's any other memories of that time, feel free to share, but I guess I'll kind of jump you forward to 1941. You would have been 18 years old, huh?
Yeah,
December 7th, you remember?
Oh, yeah, very well. Me and my buddy and our girlfriends were sitting at a hot dog stand in Fresno. I forget the name of it, but it was a well-known hot dog stand, and it was cheap. We could afford 10 cents a hamburger or something. But at 11 o'clock, that's when we heard about it. So we come home, and me and my two buddies joined the Army. We went out here to the recruiting place, and they told us if we would recruit and join the Army, we would get to stay together. So we did get to stay together until we got to Monterey, the Paseo de Monterey, and I never seen him again until after the war was over. We got on a troop train in Monterey and went the southern route, and one of them got off in Texas, and the other one got off in Arizona, and they sent me all the way to Camp Stuart, Georgia.
Ooh, that's a long way from Clovis. Yeah.
And those old Georgia people didn't like soldiers at Savannah because the soldiers would mess with their daughters and the lawns. And So there was a big sign on the lawns, "Soldiers and dogs keep off the lawn."
Soldiers and dogs are in good company. Yeah. You know, a couple other questions come to mind. I don't want to jump around too much with you. But during those years, when you're a kid and you quit school after eighth grade because you need to work, and you're working whatever agricultural field you can find to make a few cents. Do you remember having any dreams or ambitions or thoughts of, you know, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
Well, I worked hard, and I knew I didn't want to be a poor guy like my dad and mother were. I'm just sorry I couldn't have helped them more. I wish I had it to do over. I'd help them. But I got out in 46. 47, I got married. And we weren't going to have any kids for 5 years till we kind of got on our feet. And we had two the first 5 years. I found out where they were coming from, so I got that taken care of. But when I got discharged at Camp Beale, I come home on the train. And my three buddies got out before I did. And they were waiting at the train, and they said, "You're going to go to work tomorrow." And I said, "What am I going to do?" And they says, "You're going to be a carpenter." And they were moving the barracks from Hammer Field. They were tearing them apart and putting them up where the park is now, right here at Sierra and Clovis Avenue, for the veterans to live in. And so I bought me a pair of overalls and a hammer and a saw, and that's where I went to work. I told them I wanted to draw my 5220. You know what that is. You get
$20 a week for 52 weeks.
But they said, "No, you're going to work." So I was fine. I went to work, and I really enjoyed it. And I've been a carpenter ever since. I built a lot of houses around Clovis. I didn't do any commercial, just houses.
So let's go back. You mentioned finding out about Pearl Harbor while you're at the hot dog stand on that Sunday morning. Was that a big deal? Did that get a reaction from you?
Well, yes, it did. I'm not bragging, but I wanted to join the Army, and I wanted to go overseas. I really trained hard, and I drove for the battery commander for a while. And I told him, "I want to go overseas. I don't want to fool around." And so, young and foolish, so when we got out of basic training, we got on a ship, and it was an old ship that was captured in World War II, Williams and Mary. It was made for 1,000 people, and there was 3,000 of us on it. So we stood in line for everything we did. I was down in the engine room floor, and hotter than a son of a gun. And it was about four floors down. The hammocks were about 11 inches apart. And when you got in one, you didn't turn over. You just had to lay in that position.
Yeah.
So me and my buddy would wait till 12 o'clock at night, and then we'd go up and take our blanket and sleep by the smokestack. It was nice and warm. We'd get in there and hide, and that's where we would sleep. So the seagulls, they were with us all the way. Because when we left, we seen one with his leg off. And he just had one leg. And when we got overseas, he was still with us. But the ship would throw out a lot of stuff. And the waste from the toilet. And the toilet was a 12-inch pipe about that big.
Yeah.
And they had a stool welded on every 36 inches. And there was probably 10. You had to stand in line to use it. And the ocean water comes up through there, pumps it all of that, you don't flush it or anything, the water.
Yeah.
And so one day a wise guy got an idea, and he, at the head of the pipe, he lit a newspaper and let it go down through there. And everybody jumped up, hair was all burnt off. So
wise
we got
guys,
to England,
right. Yeah.
And we took amphibious training. And that's going up and down a rope ladder on a ship and all that stuff. That's what we did. And then June the 6th, 1944, we got on the ship at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we headed across the English Channel to Normandy. And we got there and all hell broke loose. We were getting out of the, onto the landing barges. And they couldn't get up to the shore, because Hitler had drove iron stakes in the ground out about 8 or 10 feet. And so we had to, we couldn't get out on the sand. We had to jump out with a 90-pound pack and a rifle. And a lot of the kids couldn't make it. I was a good swimmer, and I was young and been on the farm and strong. And so I made it. And going up there, I got something right here in this leg. And so they took me to the ship hospital and just... the medics took care of it and put me back in the field, back on. And so that was one time the medic took care of it, no doctor. They were taking care of the ones that really needed them.
I think everybody hears you describe those things. You lived them, and maybe it's not that big a deal to you, so you tell it very matter-of-factly, but there are some pretty intense situations that you were in. You've been training in England. Yeah. You said they got you up at 3 in the morning on June 6th to head across the channel, but... did you know that was coming? Had you had a sense or an indication?
We didn't know where we were going.
But you knew something was going to happen.
Yeah.
What kind of weapons were you supposed to use?
Then I just, my machine gun was on the way over, you know, in case we got there. I just had an M1 rifle.
So as you're getting off the ship.
We just had an M1 rifle.
An M1 rifle, and you said a 90-pound pack.
Yeah.
But they can't get you to the beach.
No.
You got to do some swimming to get there.
Right.
With 90 pounds on your back.
And a rifle.
And a rifle. And you're seeing some of the other guys sinking below the surface.
Yeah, they already got killed.
You, before you even reached the beach, some of your buddies drowned.
They didn't make it. They drowned, yeah.
And you're soaking this in as a 21-year-old kid with bullets flying and artillery going off and planes overhead and all kinds of craziness. What was going through your mind in those moments?
Well, I was scared.
I would have been.
And I thought, boy, I wish they'd shoot me. Get it over with.
Really?
You know, because everybody was getting shot and getting hurt. The only thing that saved me, I guess, they took me out to the ship and worked on my leg. But it was a horrible life, you know, a horrible thing to see those young guys getting killed. And as I was crawling up the beach, I would hide behind some of the dead ones. You know, I just crawled, and I'd get their rifle and their guns, I mean their ammunition, because I'd run out of ammunition.
I know I'm going back and forth, but another question that strikes me. Before you got there, when they get you up at 3 in the morning and you've got this journey across the channel and you don't know what to expect, during those hours, were there some thoughts going through your mind? Did you think, I might not see tomorrow?
Yeah.
So what do you do with that? Do you just close your eyes and grit your teeth?
Yeah,
do you say a prayer? Do you talk to your buddies?
Yeah.
What do you do?
You think, well, I'm awful young to die,
yeah,
but I'm probably going to. And, you know, if it hadn't been for a bunch of us old poor roughneck boys, it might have been different. But most of the guys around here that went in service were just farm boys and old hard-working guys with muscles, you know, and that's what saved my life. I was poor all my life, and I knew how to take care of myself.
Mm. But then you're hitting this beach, and as you said, guys are dying around you. The bullets are flying. If you have to take these other rifles from the dead, it means you've been firing your gun at the enemy and running out of ammunition, hiding behind dead bodies. They've called that day the longest day. Is that what it felt like to you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And explain to us how you got hurt, because you said that injury at that point maybe saved your life.
I don't know if it was a grenade or what, but it just tore my leg up right there, and the medics just sewed it up. They could take care of it. And then another time, see this, I got a scar right across there.
Let me ask you about that in a bit, because I want to stay on the 6th. So you get some kind of shrapnel from something, whether it's a shell, a grenade, or whatever, in the back of your left calf.
Yeah.
That makes it really hard to walk.
Yeah.
So they get you off the beach, medics got you, and get you back to your ship. How long do you think you were back on the ship before you went back to the shore?
I was probably less than a day, because they sewed it up and wrapped it up real good and told me to get going.
But in those hours, whether that's 12 hours or 24 hours, thousands died.
Yeah.
You would have been, very likely could have been
one of them, yeah.
So getting hurt saved your life.
Probably saved my life.
But then you're going right back into it.
Yeah.
And you probably didn't feel that great. It had to be some pain you're dealing with.
Yeah, well, I was young and tough, and they did a good job sewing it up and wrapping it up. You know, the medics were, the sergeant was a good friend of mine, and he took good care of me.
Was there a point in those next couple days where you came to grasp the magnitude of what happened there, or how extreme the casualties were?
Yeah, but we were gone. As soon as we got the lead wave, we could get out of there. Well, we got out of there. But what I didn't tell you is that Churchill and Eisenhower had already planned to bomb the up above, you know, where the Germans were.
Right.
Bomb all the gun positions.
Right.
But it was foggy, and the planes couldn't take off. You know, those old planes then, they didn't have all this radar stuff. And so we were just setting ducks. If they could have got there and bombed those, it would have been a much easier deal to take the beach. But see, Hitler knew that we were going to land there weeks ahead of time. He had set up all the gun positions, and he was shooting at the ships. And ships had big guns, and they were shooting at the gun positions too.
Right.
Up above.
You can still find some craters up on those cliffs today from the American ships that were shelling them. You mentioned seeing guys die around you. Did you lose some guys that you knew pretty well that day?
Yeah. Some of my buddies that I trained with.
As a 21-year-old, how did you deal with that? Here are these guys that you've gotten to know all through training and that...
Well, you just have to take it with a grain of salt and go on. Do your job.
Mm. And you were able to do that already at that point?
I figured I'd be next.
You know? And they're buried there at Normandy?
Yeah.
Have you ever been back?
No, I've never been back there. A couple of times they've took the bunch of soldiers back there, but I never got on that drill. I'd like to get on it, but it's hard for me to get around.
That's the reality at nearly 93 years old. It may be tough to get around, but he's more than able to take us back in time and share his memories from World War II. Right now, it's time for our first break, but when we come back, more about the injuries Ray suffered during the war and the issues he still deals with today because of the conditions he faced during the Battle of the Bulge. You can see what this tall farm boy looked like during World War II and the way he looks now if you check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with Ray Ritchie of Clovis, California. If you live in that area, maybe he built your house. That's the business he was in after the war. But first, he had to survive the war. and that was not easy. He told us about how he was hurt on Omaha Beach on D-Day and how being evacuated from that beach may be what saved his life. He mentioned some other injuries that took place later, including your right hand. How did that happen?
I fell through a plate-glass window, and they cut that right across there. And so I went to the medics, and they sewed it up. And they said if it had been another eighth of an inch, it would have got the main artery, and I would have probably bled to death.
And how'd you go through a plate-glass window? Were you just being clumsy or what?
No, it was. We were going through the houses to get in the Germans. You go upstairs, and when you come down, there's a landing there, and then you go down the other way.
Uh-huh.
And a big plate glass window there. And so we were in a hurry, and I went through that plate glass window.
Ouch.
Yeah.
So an eighth of an inch.
Yeah.
So that's a couple of close calls you've shared already. There was also the time a mortar blast threw you into a truck, and you're also still dealing with the effects of the brutal weather you encountered during the Battle of the Bulge.
My feet just froze, and I couldn't, I couldn't walk. And they just turned purple all the way up to here, and my hands froze. I still don't have much use of my hands or my feet.
So your legs were purple to the knee?
Yeah.
And you couldn't feel your fingers? And you've dealt with the effects of this for 70 years?
Yeah, and I had two kids. When I come home from work, they'd say, Daddy, pull your boots off so we can peel your legs off. So they'd peel my legs. All the old dead hide on them.
Right.
And that was every night,
For years.
Yeah, they were 3 and 4. I've always been kind of crippled, They just don't want to move. This one here is just about lost all of its feelings.
Your left leg.
Yeah.
There are guys who've got, a lot of guys have gotten purple hearts simply for frozen feet during the Battle of the Bulge. And here you've got frostbite up to your knees and in your fingers, not to mention being wounded on D-Day in the plate glass window, and you still don't have your purple heart. Does that matter to you at all? Does it bother you?
It don't matter to me at all, because it's not worth anything. What do you do with it? My son's got 3 hanging up in there.
Yeah.
And they don't make him a living or anything. He don't show anybody.
Yeah.
He got the Bronze Star.
Yes, your son Richard is a decorated U.S. Marine Corps veteran from the Vietnam War. And before we're done, I want to talk to you about a special mission the two of you went on together in more recent history. But as far as the Battle of the Bulge and that awful winter in a European forest, what else can you tell me about that?
The trees are so thick that the sun never gets down to the ground. And we got snowed in. We would walk all day, and we weren't prepared for that, So we would walk all day, and our feet would get wet, and then at night they would freeze. And so my feet and my hands froze. Me and my two buddies were out in the forest shooting at Germans, and they were shooting at us. And we were hiding behind trees, and we snuck up on a camp, and we captured 37 Germans. And we were marching them down to be interrogated. And one of the guys says, Ray, how many shells do you have? I said, I've got 4 or 5. How many do you have? I got 5 or 6. I think we all had, the three of us had 15 shells. And so we says, we're talking to each other, well, if these suckers try to attack us, let's line them up 4 at a time and shoot 4 at a time. Save ammunition. And so one of the guys could speak English, and he says, you guys don't have to worry. We're not going to try to attack you. And I said, well, how come you just speak good English? And he says, well, I worked on Boulder Dam. And I said, well, what are you doing over here fighting for Hitler? And he said, I thought Hitler was going to rule the world, and I wanted to be on the winning side.
Wow.
So he gave me a $20 bill.
Did that raise your eyebrows a little bit?
Yeah. I'd never seen a $20 bill.
Much less from a guy wearing a German uniform speaking perfect English that you just captured.
So the field artillery needed a machine gunner.
Uh-huh.
So I went with that.
50 caliber.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
At that time, I only had a tripod and a machine gun. I didn't have the 4 machine guns like we had before.
The quad 50s.
The planes were shot down, most of them. Hitler ran out of gas.
Yep.
And he didn't have any gas to get the planes up in the air.
Right.
So they didn't need the 4 caliber and the turret anymore.
Uh-huh.
So I just had a single barrel 50 caliber.
Uh-huh.
Every fifth one was a tracer.
Right.
After that, we kept moving from town to town, and the liaison plane, you know what that is. So there was two lieutenants, the first lieutenant and the second lieutenant in that liaison plane.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times, one of them would be sick or on another assignment, and they'd call me to go. And I'd use the binoculars, and we'd spot the Germans and then go get them the next day. So then we were moving, and we parked in a where there wasn't any trees. And then there was trees all around us, but...
out in a clearing?
Yeah, out in a clearing, yeah. And so these five planes flew over, and I had my machine gun set up. I shot at them, and I could see where I was missing them because they were going away from me, and they're hard to hit when they're going away from you. So this one goofy guy, he thought he'd come back and get me. He knew where I was because he could see my tracers. And he thought he'd come back and get me. And so he come back, and he was shooting at me, and he was breaking the limbs off the tree of about 2 feet above my head. And so, but he couldn't get low enough to get me. So I got him, and he flew into the trees and crashed, and he was dead. He had two bullet holes in him. And so the battery commander was from Colorado, and he was a duck hunter. And he wanted the uniform because they have batteries right here and the whole uniform is wired. We got him the uniform, and then I got his sword and another guy got his boots. So we left him with no clothes.
You had taken a shot at him. He's flying away from you. He knows you can't get him, and he thinks I can come back and get that machine gun.
There was five planes went over, but he was the one that come back to get me. And he knew where I was.
He's firing away at you, and it's hitting the tree right above your head.
Yeah, right.
Only about a foot above your head?
Oh, about 2 feet above my head, shooting the limbs off the trees.
Right.
But he couldn't get low enough because he had to get up over the trees. The trees were 100 feet high.
Right. So he didn't have the angle on you.
Yeah.
But you had the angle on him.
Yeah.
You shoot him down. How close to you did he crash?
Probably 50 feet.
50 feet from
He went into the trees.
Uh-huh.
And then the plane fell down.
And you went over there to investigate, and you found that you had shot him.
Yeah, I have the sword about that long.
You still have it?
Uh-huh. I give it to my daughter. She's got it. And then when we had the prison camp,
right,
one of the guys could speak a little English, and he told me, you bring me a piece of wood and a picture, and I'll carve it out for you. So I took him a picture off of a Look magazine of Betty Grable leaning up against a champagne glass in her bathing suit.
Uh-huh.
And this piece of wood was the end of an apple box. It says 1945, 30 number 10 cans on the back side.
Right.
And my son has that picture now. He carved it out about a quarter of an inch deep.
And it looks just like her?
Yeah.
I wonder if Betty Grable ever knew that there were wood carvings of her out there in Germany.
The only thing is that I bought my son a BB gun when he was about, and he shot her once right here.
You mean he was trying to shoot the swimsuit strap off? Is that what he was doing? What a character.
My son went, he got 16, and he said, if you don't sign for me to go in the Marines, I'll lie about maids and get in anyway. So I signed for him, and he took basic training at Camp Pendleton, and then he went to Vietnam and got wounded three times. But he come home, he's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He still gets shrapnel out of his legs and his face, but he's all right. He worked every day.
Well, I think we know where he picked up that work ethic, don't we? And sorry, I know we're bouncing around, but so you told the story about shooting down that German plane. And I guess the war was just about over by then, right?
That was just about the end of it for me. I had 85 points and I could come home.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted me to stay and be the sergeant over the... We had 4,000 German prisoners in a prison camp. And they wanted me to be the sergeant of the guard over that. And so I volunteered for 6 more months. And we'd go out there every morning and there'd be two or three guys froze to death. Or they... didn't have any mess kits. They eat out of tin cans and get dysentery and die. And so they didn't have any dog tags. And Germany was all tore up. And what are you going to do with them?
Right.
So we'd just take them out. And the bulldozer dug a big trench. We'd just put them in that and cover them over. And because what else could we do?
Right.
We couldn't leave them laying around. After that 6 months, why, I told them I wanted to come home. I was ready. War was over for me.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on a ship to New York.
Right.
And then in New York, they put us in an old C-47 that had wooden benches, not no seats. And so we had to ride in that thing till we got to San Francisco. They trucked us to an old warehouse, open-air warehouse, up about 5 feet high, the floor. And we stayed there for 7 or 8 days and lived, eat out of our mess kits and slept on a cot. And after that, they trucked us to Camp Beale, and that's where we got discharged. And they said, do you want to stay 2 or 3 more days and tell us about your wound? Because I forgot to tell you that I was too close to a mortar that went off and it blew me into a truck. They took me to the tent hospital. And they said, I heard him say, well, he won't walk anymore. So the next day I got up and took off and went back to my outfit.
He had to show them, huh?
Yeah. So we got to Camp Beale and I said, I don't want to stay here and I just want to go home. So they give me my discharge and I come home.
So in other words, they're saying, if you stick around, we'll take inventory of everything that happened to you. And if you're deserving of the Purple Heart, we'll process that. And you said, I don't care about the Purple Heart. I want to get home.
What good do you have a Purple Heart? Don't feed you or make you any money. So I just come home and went to work the next day and have worked ever since.
Uh-huh. Because your friends were there and said, we've got a job for you. You're going to be a carpenter.
And my friends were there, and 3 months later, I was their foreman.
Uh-huh. And 70 years later, you still don't have a Purple Heart. Even though you were wounded multiple times.
I never turned in for anything.
Well, we need to turn toward our final commercial break, but we're going to hear about an experience Mr. Ritchie had that any surviving World War II veteran can enjoy for free, a trip to the National World War II Memorial through the Honor Flight Network. Mr. Ritchie was part of the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight out of Fresno, California in 2013. You can find photos from that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear what it meant to him when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with Ray Ritchie of Clovis, California. He'll turn 93 at the end of July. He never attended high school, but he got quite an education in the Army during World War II. From Omaha Beach on D-Day to the Battle of the Bulge to 6 months of occupation duty guarding German prisoners of war after it all ended. In 2013, when Central Valley Honor Flight took its initial contingent of World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. to see their memorial, Mr. Ritchie was on that flight with his son Richard, a Marine Corps veteran wounded 3 times in Vietnam, serving as his guardian. So here we have father and son, both wounded in action, both of you lost friends in battle. You see the World War II Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial, the Korean War Memorial. You're experiencing all of that with all these other vets and with each other. What did you get out of that experience?
I just didn't realize there was that many people killed. The American Memorial or the Vietnam, that just, have you seen it? It
with 58,000 names, yeah.
And then Korea does too. And it just makes you sick to think of all the nice young men that got killed.
And at the World War II Memorial, there aren't any names, but there's a wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died. So many of them on June 6th, and you were there at Omaha Beach. What did you think of when you took in that sight at the World War II Memorial?
Well, it just brought back memories of what happened.
Did it make you think of some of those friends of yours who died that day?
Yeah. You know, they were just young men and 20 years old and just getting started in life. But they never got to live to see what happened.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about how their lives would have turned out? What kind of things they would have done?
Yeah, I've thought about that. I wondered what they would have done. My one buddy, he turned out to be a bartender in Eureka. He died early. And then another buddy lived in Watsonville. He was a plumber and he died early. And then my good buddy in Fresno, his name was Donald Turnipseed. They had a grocery store on 9th and Madison in Fresno. And he got killed in amphibious. We were taking amphibious training. And he was driving an amphibious truck. And the motor died and a big wave come in. And it rolled over and over up on the beach and crushed him. And so I brought him home.
So he died before you guys even crossed the channel.
Yeah.
And when you say you brought him home, you mean when you came home from the war, you came with his body?
No, I went to see his parents and told them about what happened.
Mm. What was that like, having to explain to
them?
Well,
I'll tell you, it was rough. Because he was a good buddy and a good guy, a good clean-cut guy. But he was about the same age as I was.
Uh-huh.
He had a little better life than I had because his dad and mother had a grocery store. And his dad worked for PG&E.
When you think about that, and even maybe there in Washington, D.C., when you're at that World War II memorial and they throw out that number, 406,000, and it's so shocking. You ever think, that could have been me?
Yeah.
My 2 kids, 5 grandkids, 2 great-grandkids wouldn't be
here? They wouldn't be here.
How do you account for that? How do you account for the fact that you did survive?
Just being lucky and strong and healthy and being poor and learning how to live without things.
While you were over there, did you ever catch wind of what was happening in the concentration camps?
No, I never did. But my buddy was in one, Glenn Duncan. He was a tail gunner, and the German shot it in two, half in two. And he rode the tail section down, and he broke his leg and his shoulder. And the German women run out there with pots and pans and skillets and beat him up. And they finally took him to the hospital and he got put in a concentration camp. And he was one of the 3 that went in with me. When he come home, he was kind of lost part of it. Mm-hmm. And he was in there for a couple of years. And I went over to see him and his mother said, well, he's out in the garage. So I went out there and he jumped out from behind the garage and threw me on the ground. Finally, he realized that. He says, I thought you were a German.
Mm.
He and a couple of buddies dug a tunnel, and they got out, but they got captured again the next day and beat up.
unfortunately, he wasn't executed. A lot of them were in those circumstances.
I wanted to be a gunner on one of the planes, either a waist gunner or a tail gunner.
Uh-huh.
And I was too tall, and I couldn't get down in the turret. So I guess I'm pretty lucky that I didn't.
Well, I don't know that anybody was wanting to trade places with you while you were on Omaha Beach on D-Day. But you're right. Those bomber crews were in harm's way all the time. And to be clear, that was a prisoner of war camp where the conditions were never kind and accommodating. But those were all the captured Allied prisoners. I don't want any of our listeners to confuse it with the concentration camps where Jewish people and other political prisoners were tortured and executed. But I want to bring you back around to Honor Flight. I know you packed a whole lot into 3 days, a ton of highlights, and you had a huge crowd cheering for you when you came home. But what was the number one moment for you out of that whole experience? What would you say was the most satisfying or fulfilling?
Well, seeing the memorial, you can spend a day there, and it was real pretty. The weather was pretty. I really enjoyed that. Hmm. And to top it all off, my son was rolling me in a wheelchair.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he walked off and left me. And I was, hey, you're forgetting something here. And then somebody started rolling me. And it was my grandson. He was stationed in Virginia. He's a master sergeant in the Marines. And he come over there to see me. He started rolling me.
And you didn't know he was coming?
I didn't know he was coming. My son fixed it up. So it was only, a 2 or 3 hour drive from where he was stationed to over there.
Uh-huh.
So he come over there. I got a picture of him up there. He's a master sergeant. He's been in 22 years.
Wow.
He's going to retire next year. But he's been overseas a lot of times.
Well, that's quite a surprise. I wonder how many guys visiting that memorial have a moment like that where their Purple Heart recipient son and their Marine grandson are there with them.
That was really, I thought, what the heck's going on here, you know, because him and I are real good buddies. I kid him all the time about the Marines don't know what they're doing, and the Army does, and he don't much go for that.
Uh-huh. Well, I can tell you're proud of your grandson, and I know you're proud of your son's service in Vietnam. What about for you? When you think back to everything that you saw, that you went through, that you experienced, what are you most proud of?
Well, that I got home alive. That's the best part about it. And now I go to the Veterans Hospital. I see all those guys with their legs off and their arms off. And I just think how lucky I was. You know, I was just really lucky. That's all I can say.
It's all about perspective. Somebody may be hearing you talk about getting hurt on D-Day or hurting your hand later or dealing with frozen feet and frozen fingers and trying to work as a contractor in spite of all those handicaps, and yet you say you're the lucky one.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be hard for some other folks to feel sorry for themselves. When June 6th comes up on the calendar every year, does that mean something to you?
Not necessarily. You know, after 75 years, you forget that kind of stuff. But I do think about what if we hadn't won the war, what would happen? Hitler would have been over here and it had been under his rules.
He had his headquarters all planned out in Los Angeles. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
They had some American sympathizers who built a big old complex, and it's right by Griffith Park. It's still there. They haven't really changed it. Yeah. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. It's pretty remarkable. And it does help us understand what you and those other guys went through. You said you're most proud of coming home. How about what, at almost 93 years old, what are you most thankful for?
Well, being as healthy as I am and having a lot of good friends.
You just threw out there, you think about what if the other side had won, how different things would be. When you think about your grandkids and your great-grandkids and future generations of Americans, what do you think all of us who weren't alive during World War II need to understand about what you guys did?
Well, there's a lot of people your age that could care less about the soldiers. And like one of my grandsons, he said, Grandpa, you were stupid to go in the Army. You know? And so there's a lot of people out there that don't realize what the soldiers went through to keep America the way it is.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid the people we have running for president is going to mess things up. You know.
You're not alone.
There's a lady here in Clovis, a friend of mine.
Yeah.
She's from France.
Uh-huh.
And she tells everybody, you guys be good to Ray because he liberated France. She's from France.
Uh-huh.
And she tells everybody, you guys be good to Ray because he liberated France. I said, yeah, man, about 15,000 other guys.
Were there ever any funny things that happened while you were overseas in the war that you think back on and chuckle a little bit?
We had, if you got caught fraternizing with the German girls, you got put in stockade.
Right.
And so, because you might be telling them something you're not supposed to tell them.
Sure.
And so, me and my buddy would sneak under the fence, and we would go down, and there was five girls living in the house. And so, we would go down and see them at night, and get back by 12 o'clock so we'd go for bed check. And so I always volunteer for things. And one night the battery commander says, Richie, get four guys and we're going on a, we're going to check all the houses and make sure there's no Germans. And so the first house we went to was that one. And one of the girls had a little baby and my buddy's name was Brown. And she says, here, Brown, hold the baby.
Uh-oh.
The battery commander looked at me, and I looked at him. He said, Brown, come to my office when we get back.
At least he didn't say Richie.
They didn't mention my name, and I was sure glad.
Well, I'm sure glad we've been able to share your name and your story with our listeners today. That's Ray Richie of Clovis, California. Check out the photos and a short video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And while you're there, look for the link to the Honor Flight Network. I know I talk about this a lot on Hometown Heroes, but I don't know if there's anything happening right now that's better for our aging veterans to experience. I was just part of another homecoming celebration a little over a week ago, and every single time, I'm reminded of just how powerful this experience is, not just for our veterans, but for the guardians who go with them, for their families, for people from all walks of life who come together to celebrate those who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. The website is honorflight.org, and that can connect you to hubs all over the country. Wherever you're listening today, there are volunteers devoting their time, talents, and treasure to making sure that all surviving World War II veterans who want to see their memorial not only have that opportunity, but end up with a life-changing, life-affirming, and in some cases, life-defining experience. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again for our next edition of Hometown Heroes, when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.